You're listening to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm your host, Amy Stone. Here, I share stories from real people navigating the adventure that I call adulting. Are you ready? Me too. Let's do this. Well, hello, friends. In this episode, I'm going to introduce you to my guest, Stephanie Sands. And what we talk about is how her experience of having a panic attack on a subway train changed the trajectory of her life. So one of the things that I think you'll like about this particular story is actually just the simple act of sharing a story about a panic attack, because this is something that probably each and every person watching and listening to the show is aware of, they know about. We see panic attacks portrayed on TV and in the movies. Maybe we've heard friends, family members, acquaintances talk about having panic attacks. Without a doubt, many of the people listening probably have personal experience of panic attacks for themselves. So for most of my life, there was a very direct and just overtly expressed reality that mental health struggles should absolutely be hidden and kept private because of the real consequences that the knowledge of those things in the public could have for people. Today in 2025 and 2026, I think that two things are simultaneously true. First, there is absolutely more public awareness and hopefully acceptance of the truth that many people do experience anxiety and worry and panic attacks and other mental health conditions. But I do think it's interesting because I think it is still accurate to say that there can be very real consequences in a community or a society if and when you go public with this stuff in your own life. So with all that being said, let's get to the interview with Stephanie Sands. Stephanie Sands, welcome to The Art of Imperfect Adulting. I'm so happy you're here. Are you ready for a fun chat today?
I think I am, yeah.
All right, let's see. It's not a test. All right, I start all of my interviews, all of my conversations, the very same question. What part of the world do you call home?
Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. That is a really, really strong community. It's one of the things that's really interesting about Brooklyn. My husband is from Brooklyn, not me, but my husband. And he and his dad will do this thing when they meet somebody else from Brooklyn that I have called the Brooklyn conversation, which they will connect on being from Brooklyn and be like lifetime friends based on a 15-second conversation. It's the craziest thing I've ever seen. So Brooklyn is a whole vibe. All right. Very cool. Next question. What is one way that you like to recognize or honor something that's worthy of celebration? And I gave, for everybody who's watching and listening, I gave Stephanie this question with like 15 seconds of prep time, and she's been stressing about it since then.
Yeah. I think it's just because there's just a lot going on. So many things I think that can be said, and I want to offer something that's inspirational. So I guess my answer would be just, especially towards women, don't be afraid to step in your own power.
Okay.
No matter what the odds are. The whole concept of femininity and our strength, and especially now that I've become a mother, I have two young children, I've had a whole other realm of femininity and womanhood that has opened up that I'm experiencing personally. So I would say that stepping into your own power as a woman, however you believe that should be. Don't be afraid to do that.
All right. Very cool. Very good. All right. So let's get into the main feature topic of the day. Once upon a time, you passed out, as in you lost consciousness on a New York City subway train. And this led you to making some changes in your life, which makes sense to me. This sounds like a very urgent experience that you went through. So my first question is about the actual like loss of consciousness. You were in the train, not on the platform, is I think my understanding of this. Were you standing up and you fell down and you lost consciousness? Like, what happened?
Yeah, so I was in college. I was pursuing my undergraduate degree in psychology, and I was on my way to an internship at a day facility for adults that are mentally developmentally delayed.
Okay.
It was during rush hour in the morning. Got on the train. I was standing up, but I had this sense of dread. And when I went into the subway train, there were no seats. It was packed, and the sense of dread just was so powerful. And I started panicking because I just wanted to sit down. All I wanted to do was sit down. I felt that would feel better if I sat down. And it just so happened that a seat became available, and I rushed to sit down. But at that point, I was just already, my ears had started ringing, my eyesight started closing. It's kind of like a weird experience. Or you see, like, I was seeing neon colors in my periphery, and then all of a sudden it fades to black. And so apparently I sat down with my venti hot chai latte in my hand and just passed out. My whole latte fell into my bag. Thank God it didn't, like, fall on anybody else, but it just fell into my bag. I then I you know on the subway train where I passed out, when I finally regained consciousness, I was no longer on the train. I was, in fact, on the platform two stops away.
All right, so now I want to ask a little bit. So this was when you were in college and you were doing intern work. How much time frame was it? How long ago was this year's?
Oh,
You can give a range. Like it doesn't have to be precise, but like
years ago, I would say 14 years ago.
14 years ago. So quite a long time ago. All right. So subway trains and platforms are not the cleanest things I think of. Not super hygienic.
I
Soon as we
included.
were, were you? It sounds like you were alone.
I was alone.
You were alone. So when you lose consciousness, does anybody like respond to this, or you're just unconscious and people let you be? Which is not the most unusual thing that would happen on a New York City train, to be honest.
Right. And I was fortunate that people didn't just go on about their day, trying to get to work. When I started slowly regaining consciousness on that platform, I could hear people talking around me, and it sounded like two women had worked together to take me off the train and put me
Okay.
on. And so I could hear at least two women talking to what sounded like a security guard or an officer, explaining that we don't know her. She just fainted. And we thought the best thing to do was to take her off the train and get some help.
Okay. All right. So anybody who's ever fainted probably identifies with the way you're describing these symptoms, and other people who have not may not have been familiar with the way the world sort of collapses around you. Like the sound gets real weird, and then all those things. All right. So then, as this happens, do you get medical response or like working with like a helper at that point? Is that when, or are you allowed to say, no, I'm fine. I'm going on about my day.
Because I was paralyzed, I couldn't move, I couldn't talk. My consciousness started coming back. I could hear, and I wanted to say, "I'm having a pan. I just had a panic attack."
Okay.
Wasn't I knew what a panic attack felt like because I've had them before. My first a panic attack, I believe I experienced was around 8 or 9 years old. So, and then, between 8 or 9 years old up until that point, I had experiencing several acute episodes of panic. So I knew I just couldn't say anything. I couldn't move my mouth. So I did find comfort in hearing the conversation, though, because the officer or the security guard, whoever it was, said, I've dialed in the ambulance, so I knew help was coming. It's for many people that have panic attacks and they're very familiar with the situation. It's very scary because sometimes, right, you don't know for sure if it's a panic attack. It could be
Right.
something else, and it could just be that one time that something happens, you might think that it's a panic attack, but it could be, like a heart attack or a stroke. And so for me, even though that feeling was also familiar, I was happy to hear about the ambulance just in case it could have possibly been something else.
Yeah, no, everybody that I've ever talked to about a panic attack, and I was going to ask you about this. So you were aware you'd had moments of panic, but everybody I've ever talked to about a panic attack has had a moment or a season where they are trying to figure out, or they think that it is an acute physical thing, like a stroke, a seizure, a heart attack, and then they rule it out. And many people that I've talked to about this, they actually, it's they don't want to. It's hard to believe or to understand that this very physical manifestation of events could be from panic. Could be from panic. But you were aware, you had experienced moments of panic before, and so you were coming to alertness with the idea that this was a panic attack.
Correct, yeah.
So then tell us what, so you tell us, not for the people who are listening who have experienced it or think they might have experienced it, or if they're wondering if someone in their life is experiencing a panic attack, take us back to that moment of dread when you got on the train, and try and walk us through, like, from inside your body and your personal experience, what was the feeling and this sort of pattern of awareness that you went through. If you remember, because there's like, you don't necessarily remember all of the things that happen, right, when you lose consciousness. But what was the sensation that you experienced? Because dread, if you can dial it in a teeny tiny bit more, like, what did it feel like for you?
Well, so I think a lot of people that have panic attacks don't know the triggers. But for me, I kind of understood that something was about to happen because usually, well, let's go back to myself in this situation. I had a thought of, oh my gosh, it's really early. I'm really tired. And that internship was really challenging. And I was dreading going to the internship because I didn't know what to expect that day. And so I think the first thing that happens, whether or not you're aware of it, is that there's a thought, right? Or it could be a physical sensation that all of a sudden you just become hot and then you immediately associate it with, oh my God, I'm experiencing anxiety, and then a spiral happens. But for me, it was having those thoughts that triggered the physical symptoms, and it just snowballed. So the thought of dread of going to this internship that I did not enjoy, and in fact, when I say this is a challenging internship, I mean it was really, really challenging. People got hit. I've got hit in the head, like my head was a basketball before at this internship. I really didn't. I didn't want to go, and I was just really, really tired and dreading going. So that instant thought turned into an instant feeling and then an instant spiral.
And so, to follow that through, that thought, you didn't want to go. And then, is part of the pressure that you do not have a way to make the decision to not go? You feel like you have to go, even though you don't want to.
I think that is at least it, so each person has their own triggers and their own way that they interpret the thought and the feeling. And for me, it was the sense of I don't have control,
Okay.
I cannot just call out and say I am sick, or even though if I were truly sick, I would need to, but I had this sense that I did not have a choice. I
All right.
did not have control. And that is a big thing with people who experience panic and anxiety is this sense of feeling out of control, right? And so
Sure.
for me, it was definitely that I felt I absolutely had to go to this internship. There were no other options.
And so to sort of zoom out a little bit for where you were in your life about this, this is in the later stages of pursuing this undergraduate degree where you're beginning to work in the field, but you've already invested time, money, effort in the process of declaring this major, picking a degree, which is going to give you as an adult the credentials and credibility for the professional experience you think you want. So you've got a lot riding on sort of the process of this and what it will be for you. And so I think that makes sense. And then your physical environment, and you've said, it's going to be different for everybody and everybody does things differently, but we're talking about your experience on this one day 14 years ago. And I want to thank you for taking the time to sort of think back to what it felt like then as a description of what it was. Okay, so this is a moment that leads to a personal shift in what you do, and it changes your life. But let's talk a little bit more about what was going on for you at that time to set the scene for why it would do that. So you were finished. Am I right about this? This is the end stage of your undergraduate sort of degree process when you were doing an internship? Yeah. And what did you think that what did you think at that time was your professional path? Like, what were you thinking you would do with this degree before this panic attack happened?
Well, I think at that time I was pretty confident that I wanted to become a therapist. But I had some doubts because also at the time what I was doing, I was in a relationship with a musician and I was getting more into the music scene and doing music management.
Okay.
And I enjoyed that as well. So I was actually considering going to law school and focusing on entertainment to become an entertainment lawyer. So I think what was happening at that time in my life was that I had thought that this is something that I really wanted to pursue. But if I were having this much panic over going to my internship, and now that internship wasn't reflective of my end goal of being a private practice practitioner, I just had, started to really doubt. And in my mind, maybe even on a subconscious level, I was looking for an out,
Sure.
because I'm so unsure. And that out was like, well, if I don't show up for this internship, if something, happens and I don't show up, then the whole career, my career goals, and this is obviously illogical, but my whole career goals of becoming a therapist is all washed out. And so then maybe I'll just focus on the music industry. But is that truly what I want? Is that truly my calling? I don't know. Like, should I, am I looking for this excuse? Am I looking for this out? Do I really want to disappoint, people within the field, not get a recommendation from them and then just pursue music? Or is this actually where I need to be and I just need to learn how to get through it? So even just me talking about it, stepping back into that time, I can hear myself expressing the panic and the thought spiraling that was going on in my mind.
I think that it's a very, very interesting thing. So I've got a bunch of kids, and almost all of them have gone through this career college experience. And it is a really interesting part of that process because being a student in school is not always a direct tie to doing the job. And yet, when you're in that, it's a very rigid, like on the rails path. Like it's very explicitly explained to people who are students. And I'd love to tell you this is not true in 2025 the way it was in 1991, but I do actually think it is true. When you're on the educational path, the deal is it's like, hey, follow the instructions, get the grades, pick the marketable degree, and somewhere along the line, happiness and fulfillment comes without you having to do anything. Many people go through a reckoning. Either before or after they graduate, where they realize that they're like, oh, you know what? this thing that I studied in the classroom, that's not the same as when I show up on the job and I'm not sure I like it. Or the other version of that that sometimes shows up is like, huh, there's not actually any money to be made in this thing that I studied. And so it's a big change. It's a big life change. And it's one of those wonderful examples that like so many people go through, but probably millions of people can tell you it's going to happen. And then it doesn't prepare you for the actual experience of that gut check of like, oh my gosh, is this really an important decision? And am I doing the right thing? It's one of the very first times that you make it all on your own, even though you can still be surrounded by teachers and parents and aunts and uncles and friends. It's like you have to make this decision by yourself, with your tush in the subway seat. Like, what am I doing?
Right.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting because I mean hindsight 2020. I just as what you said, we're kind of told there's this traditional path to success, wealth, happiness, all of that. And if you take any misstep that you're off the path and you're doomed, right?
Yes.
And that's kind of the message that I had in my mind, which it's gets so programmed because in someone's brain, especially if they're growing up with that message, because even then when during that at that point when I had that panic attack, I barely I by the skin of my nose graduated high school. Okay, I was a truant. I did not go to school consistently starting in fifth grade.
Okay.
I very fortunate that I somehow got my act together when I was 17, and just got enough credits to graduate high school. And I went to work at a startup for a couple of years, so I didn't go to college right away. When I started college, I was in early 20s at a community college, right? So already it's a non-traditional path.
Yeah.
And I worked my tail off there. I got accepted to my dream school, Columbia, and I went for a while. So I and for my upbringing, because I was a truant, because I had a lot of struggles, just family life and moving a lot. I was also told this message that I wasn't going to amount to anything. You don't even go to school, you're just going to be a loser. And this is coming from family members.
All right. Can I ask about that a little bit?
Sure.
Okay. So, would you describe your parents from your family of origin as high achievers?
Certainly not.
Okay. So, they were not a standing example of success that you could model. And then I don't want to get too personal because that's not the we don't need to do that. But you describe it as truant, which is an amazing word choice, and I love it. You weren't going to school. Was this, would you say, looking back, lenses 2020, because you didn't like school and you didn't want to be there, or because of the overall instability and lack of support that you had from your family of origin, that it was not really easy for you to do that?
Yeah, absolutely the latter.
Okay, so lack of support. So you were doing the best you could. You didn't have an example that was strong to follow. So you are rising against the odds by graduating. You get yourself into community school. You get a job with a startup. Then you turn that into acceptance to what is arguably one of the most academically competitive schools on the planet, Columbia in New York City. Congratulations. You should be very proud. And so you're driven. You're able to get things done. This is something your actions are representing that you can do that. You're on this path. Before we move on to what changes you made, I have two other questions about you before the panic attack. So you were in school, you felt like you were following a non-traditional path, you were overcoming a lifetime of not having what would be considered a lot of support from your family of origin and even messages of non-success. At this time, you were in a relationship with a musician, which is there. Did you have any other hobbies? Like, what else was going on in your life? Was there balance, or was it like all academics, hustle, hustle, hustle all the time?
I think, well, my hobby became, well, part of that being a part of the music scene.
Okay.
Just going out, having, fun in New York City, doing
Okay.
all things that, I saw on Sex and the City, right? That, wow, I just I felt really cool doing some of those things. And that I would call that a hobby, but
Yeah.
I did I alongside that though, I became more spiritual.
Okay.
So I was very into learning about New Age and Eastern religions, or I even took some college courses on Eastern religion. And I was finding and exploring my spiritual self. And I would, I don't know if I would say that's a hobby, because that is very personal. It's a personal development thing, but I really, really did enjoy that. And I enjoyed, academics. I really enjoyed learning. I love learning as much as possible. I love reading. I love learning new concepts. So that was my balance.
And that I think that's definitely bad. People sometimes think that hobbies have to be like, knitting and crocheting and baking and reading and those things. But live music and exploring the culture scene in the city, I definitely count that as a wonderful hobby. All right. So if you and I had known each other in real life back then, and we had gone to lunch the week before you had this panic attack, this may not be a great question, but pretend with me for a second. So we're back at that time. If I had asked you, we're at lunch and we know each other, and I had asked you like, hey, how are you, Stephanie? What do you think you would have said?
Oh, that's a very good question. Guess, it just shows the complexity of humans and our lives and the things that we're going through, because on the whole, I think I was pretty happy.
Okay.
I
Yeah.
think I was pretty, it's so weird because I could say that I felt safe and loved. And secure. But I think it was because of just being able to live on my own and having a steady, reliable place to live. Some of those basic needs that we as humans have, like food, water, like super basic food, water, shelter, and then we don't, sometimes people forget that love and belong is a basic need that we have as humans. And I had all those things, but there was something in my personal life that I felt was very up in the air and very insecure, in the sense that I didn't know where it was going, right? So there's, the instability there. So it would be a two-folded answer, I think.
No, I think that's fair. And I also think that it's fair, for people who have not lived with instability in your childhood and with your family of origin, that's a tremendous thing to have and you should be very thankful of it. But, people who do, like there's a, I mean, I am, you know much more about this than I do, but it is like so well documented that children who grew up with true instability, they struggle and search for that very aggressively. It affects probably every decision, every thought they ever make, like in their whole life. It's just running in the background. All right. So back to the day on the train and then what happened next. You have this panic attack. You realize that you have a panic attack. You go through this. Die, you were unconscious for a while, like two stops. That's going to be at least a couple minutes. You're getting the help from strangers, which is a very lucky situation because you were actually in peril and at risk, but also probably very, I'm going to use the word humiliating, embarrassing. It's like a, you were very, you were a relying on strangers, kind of thing. What changes do you make in your life as after this happens?
So when I had that panic attack, I called my supervisor, the internship, and I was honest. I was like, I'm not going to make this up, anything up. I'm really embarrassed, but I feel like I should just be honest. And I told her, and she's like, wow, okay, yeah, no, go home and rest. So she was very, very supportive. She didn't judge. She didn't reprimand me or anything like that. She understood. And Well, so a couple of things happened. One, that reminded me that this is the helping professions. Why would I think that I was, if I didn't show up, if I had some sort of issue, that my supervisor and my colleagues would not be understanding when they are working in the field of psychology. It's meant to help people. So that kind of really chipped a huge block off of this idea that I needed to always be perfect and perform, and nobody was going to give me a pass or let me have, let me be human and have, you know, an event that was very, as you mentioned, humiliating and very mentally strenuous at the very least.
Yeah.
And then the second thing happened was we are told, and therapists often work with clients this way too, is that, you know, they ask you the question like, what's the worst that can happen? But also they say, well, you know, what can you name a time in your life where you thought the worst was going to happen and then you went through it to come to find out that the worst didn't happen? It was actually okay or not as bad. And that's what I took away from the situation. Because my supervisor was very supportive, I learned that I might be creating this panic situation, thinking that the result is going to be so dire, but it's not always going to be that way. The result is not always going to be the end of the world, and
Yeah.
this is proof of that. So I walked away with that experience, with those two very salient messages
Yeah, so
that.
that and some of one of the words I hear when people talk about that is like you're when you're catastrophizing in your mental situation, sometimes it's helpful to be like, okay, so has that ever actually happened? Like, you know, has the saber-tooth tiger ever actually jumped out in your hallway? And you know, and if so, what did you do? You know, or if one did, what would you do? Like, let's run it through because actually taking it to the extreme conclusions can help you come up with a new path. Some of the time, the rest of the time, you might just be like, no, I'm pretty sure there's a saber-tooth tiger in my hallway, and that's just what I'm going to think about today. So, all right. So you come out of that with the realization that there's more people, and these are my words, not yours, that the pe you have more people on your team for support than you were giving yourself credit for. That the people who are on your professional path are going to step up, and there's space for you to course correct and make mistakes and not be cast outside of the safety zone. That's a pretty good thing. As a result of this, you make a, I think you might make some changes in your professional career.
Yeah, well, that certainly was the it let it was a domino effect of that happening, that I did want to stay in the helping professions, and I did continue on to pursue my degree, my master's, so that I could be a therapist. But it helped me learn my specialization, which is really a lot of the therapists become therapists because they want to help themselves. So for me, it was anxiety, stress and anxiety. This is what I'm going to focus on because I'm going to learn personally what it's like to use these tools, to use neuroscience, to use spirituality to help myself. And I'm going to continue to learn about it. And I'm going to use my formal education and my personal experience to help other people with stress and anxiety struggles for them.
Yeah, I love that you said that because that is it's a joke that we make that people who are in helping professions often start because they're their very first, you know, patient or client, or that we go into, you know, people who go into psychology, psychiatry, they do it because they're seeking out answers for themselves. When you look back on your self, we talked about you were in school, so you were on a professional training credential path, and you're also going through a searching journey, it sounds almost like, and that's my question there about philosophy and spirituality. Do you think you realized at that time that you were on like sort of a personal discovery journey, or were you in your mind, were you like, this is my degree path, and that's it?
No, I think they both, I was aware of both, and I
Okay.
knew that they intersected a lot.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then, and was this, all right. So then this next question, I don't know if it's a great question. I'm going to ask it anyway. I do one of these in most of my interviews. Do you imagine that if you had not had this acute panic attack in a public place around strangers that needed the intervention and support of people who were not there for you, which isn't, that is a really interesting, like, sort of thing about this story is that, you know, stability and control and security are like things that you work to develop for yourself. And this panic attack required that you rely on strangers. Like, there were strangers that had to come out and help you. So that's an interesting thing. But okay, do you think that if you hadn't had that happen on that day, you might have eventually worked your way around to, you know, finishing the degree and helping people with anxiety? Or do you think that this acute event or one like it was kind of necessary in some ways to bringing you to make this change that you did?
It's very likely that I would have finished off at least my undergraduate degree and taken another taken a break and tried to pursue something within the music industry. So
Okay.
I really do think that that happening was a very influential, impactful experience that really, really showed me that I do want to help other people who are ex who experience this. So I think it just kept me on the path that I wanted to go on rather than take that break to try and figure out if I did want to work in the music industry.
Okay, so I'm going to use some new agey, cozy words and see if they work, and you tell me if it's way off base. Would you say that this event helped bring you into alignment with your mission for what you wanted to do as your profession?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So to draw, because that's those a lot, that alignment word is one of the things that people toss around. That sometimes it's like, oh, what does that even mean? You know, like what is clarity? What is alignment? But in this case, you became very aware of what how you could use your tools to help people based on your personal experience and the things you had happened. And that to me sounds like alignment. All right. So in a second we're going to do the final fun questions, but I want to give you a chance to really specifically directly tell people about the work that you do, how you help people, and where people can find you online to connect with you after they watch or listen to the episode.
I'm a therapist. I have a private practice in Brooklyn, New York. I see clients virtually, but I also have therapists who work within my practice who also see clients. One of the things that I guess there's two things that I do within my practice, because I think back to that time. This is also another layer to this. I think back to the time when I had a panic attack that I did not have health insurance and I could not afford a therapist. Right. Those were huge. So my practice, we offer very affordable rates to a college student. So one of my missions with this practice is to help the people, the students or people who can't afford therapy, otherwise be able to afford therapy. So I offer that with my practice, and I want to help people on a larger scale, not just in New York. So I started doing coaching, so anxiety coaching. And right now I do have at stephaniesands.com, I have a freebie. It's an ebook called Four Things Your Therapist Wants to Tell You About Anxiety But Can't.
That's a
Because
fantastic title. It's a fantastic title.
well, it because therapists, you're trained to do therapy, you're not trained to do coaching, and there's a lot of things that you can't and you can't say as a therapist, but as a coach you can. And so that's exactly what I t talk about in my ebook, which is free if you go to stephaniesands.com. And then I also have a online course called Anxiety Rewired that it's on demand. It's meant to help guide you through learning how to stop anxiety quickly and over time become stress resilient. So I'm offering that because I can help people outside of New York because my license as a therapist, I can only see people within New York. But beyond, as a coach with that program, I can help more people. And I'm also working on a very near and dear project that's close to my heart that's actually It combines my spirituality journey, working with oracle cards, and neuroscience and psychology. It's a card deck to help people rewire their mind, brain, body.
Wow.
And it's, it bring in the intuition with, pulling a card, but bring in the repetition of neuroscience. And there's psychology concepts, behavior modification, cognitive behavior modification, cards in there. So if anybody's interested too, they can get on my email list to find out when I will be launching that project.
That is spectacular. Okay, so stephaniesands.com for the ebook and the course and joining the newsletter so that you can find out about the release of the card deck. The link for that will be in the show notes for everybody who's watching and listening. And the easiest way to get the links is always to be a subscriber to the Imperfect Adulting email community because then it lands in your email box and you can just click on it. You don't have to go and check on all the other platforms. So I put that in every single episode. That is a generous offer. I want to thank you very much for that, Stephanie. The balance between the licensing requirements of being a credentialed licensed therapist and the barriers, geographic barriers, between that and coaching is something that's been touched on in a couple other episodes. I've talked to, I think, two therapists who have modified their practice to be able to try and do certain things. So I think that that's a very current industry situation that a lot of people are dealing with. And I just want to give you a nod for bringing that up and finding your way through it. All right. Are you ready for the three questions, the final three questions?
I think
Don't be
so.
stressed out. This is like a no pressure fun thing.
I'm ready.
Stephanie is an achiever. The spontaneity of my questions, I think, stresses her out a little bit, but we're going to get through this. Okay. Today, you're a guest on my podcast. I'm curious if you listen or watch other podcasts or things like that. And if you do, if you want to share something that you enjoy, so that others can check it out for themselves.
from your
No, it's like another show. Yeah. Not one of my episodes, but another, some other show that you like.
Oof. Yeah, I have this tendency to listen to things but not really look at who.
I do that with books. This is the reason I'm not an English major because if you ask me who writes something, if you ask me what I'm reading, I'm like words that show up on my Kindle. Who's the author? I don't know. What's the title? Not sure.
Yeah, I do that pretty often, man. I can't really say podcasts as much, but certainly, as you mentioned, books. One particular book, which is very, very popular within the psychology realm, is called The Body Keeps the Score.
Oh, yeah.
Have you heard of it?
Yeah, but with Bessel van der Kerk. Is that his name?
Great. Definitely have
Yep.
heard of it. Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that is just such a great, insightful book. It can be kind of dense.
It's a little intense.
Yeah, but I think for me as a clinician, a lot of the work that I do with clients, he talks about as, one of the modalities that help with trauma for PTSD and complex trauma and neurofeedback. So a lot of people that, because within my clinical practice, I know I didn't mention this, but AI had that neuroscience interest. I use neurofeedback to help clients with anxiety and stress. And a lot of people that reach out to me for neurofeedback in New York have said, I read that book, and that's why I'm interested in neurofeedback.
It's not a new book. How long has it been out? Because it was transformative when it came out. It was polarizing and it made a big splash in the self-help world. And I'm not part of the clinical psychology world, but it was, since that came out, that's really the book that pushed the conversation about trauma into like really, really mainstream sort of stuff.
Because one the message that a lot of people get about PTSD is that you have to be a veteran, experience, sexual assault, have had experienced a significant life event, like a natural disaster or something like that. But this really talks about complex trauma, right? What I went through as a child is it can be labeled as complex trauma because just because it's not an acute episode, doesn't mean that your chronic exposure to intense stressors and anxieties don't create PTSD in the brain.
Yeah.
So I think that book is really eye-opening for a lot of people.
And one of the things that is helpful about that book is it was written by him who is, you know, he talks a little bit about himself, and you're telling your own story of it too, because there, prior to the release of that book, it was really like, oh, yay, congratulations, you have trauma. That's it. You know, you're, that's it. You know, you're done. You know, your future is foretold in a, you know, the ACE score, and go on with your life and deal with it. And he was somebody who was working and showing that there was a potential for success on the other side, which I think is, I think that's one of the reasons that it, like, people felt like it was worth it, lay people like myself, to read it and, you know, ask questions about it. But that's just my opinion, and I'm not a person who gets to, who has the credentials to voice that, but I voice it anyway. All right, anyway, next question. If you had the choice to off and not on the, that, see, that brought us back to the interview topic, but these are supposed to be lighthearted, fun questions. Let's see if it works on the second one. If you had the choice of attending a virtual conference or a summit, which is a thing we do in 2025, or going to a meeting or a conference in person, like in a hotel where you travel or whatever, which would you do? Which would you prefer, and why?
In person.
In person, yeah.
In person. It's just because I enjoy virtual. My whole practice pretty much is virtual. The work I do with people is virtual. But there's just, I need that touch of human connection in real life. But also, these conferences to me aren't just education. It's enjoyment. It's a vacation. And I love my kids. I love my family dearly. But mom needs a break sometimes. Due for a break right now. So it just even I talking about it, I'm like, oh, I would love to go in person like tomorrow.
Sign me up. Where's the registration form? There you go. All right. So if somebody comes to visit you in Brooklyn, where you live now, what is a local restaurant or an attraction, just something local, that you would tell them they should absolutely check out during their visit?
Oof. A local, well, I think food is a big thing for me that I really like. So I would say, oh man, there's a couple of places. And actually, now I'm thinking some of these places are actually in Astoria, Queens, where I used to live.
Okay, either one.
So I really, really love the bagels from Brooklyn Bagel, which is ironically named Brooklyn Bagel, but they're in Astoria, Queens. But they are delicious. You have to go there. You have to go
Okay.
there for a genuine New York bagel.
That is a wonderful recommendation. Brooklyn Bagel, which happens to be in Astoria, Queens. So I was just traveling, and we picked up bagels out of town, and I made it, like, they look like bagels, but my joke was, I was like, these are not actually bagels. These are rolls that are bagel shaped. Which is still delicious, but there's, like, you know, there's that very specific bagely thing that, you know, you get when you're at a true bagel place. That's it, Stephanie Sands. Thank you so much for being a wonderful guest today on the show.
Thanks for having me, Amy.
Thank you for listening today. I hope that you enjoy the show. And before I go, I want to encourage you to become a bigger part of the conversation. Obviously, subscribe wherever you're listening to the show. Listen to more episodes. That'd be great. Obvi, again, please write a review and tell your friends about the show. That truly is a great help for getting the show in front of new people. Okay, but more fun for you yourself, head over to imperfectadulting.com and join the email community. You'll get some free stuff right away, and that way you'll begin to get the emails about the podcast. This includes the links for the special offers from the guests, and it's the only way to get that. Also, if you aren't in the mood to listen, I actually include an article directly in those emails. Whee! Now, if you love this and you crave more time with me, Amy, as a coach, a mentor, or just adult to your adult, numero uno, check out The Village. If you have a story you want to share with the listeners, I'd love to hear from you. I have an open application. Just let me know you want it. And that's a wrap for today. Until next time, remember, the journey is the destination. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that, not me. Well, until just now, I did just say it. But what I want you to hear today is that if your adulting journey isn't going the way you expected, that may not mean that you're lost. It may just mean that you're on your way. This is Amy Stone, signing off. The Imperfect Adulting podcast is created and produced by Amy Stone and Amy Says So. Anything expressed on this show is offered as entertainment, and the views of the guests may not always represent the ideas and viewpoints of the host. That's me. Amy does not intend or hold herself out to provide professional advice or recommendations of any kind. In the end, you and you alone need to make those kinds of decisions based on your personal and individual situation, needs, circumstances, and comfort level.